Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump says his Ukrainian counterpart will visit the White House this week to sign a long-sought minerals deal. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president said the deal will give the U.S. access to Ukraine's deposit of rare earth minerals, vital for high-tech industries. He bills it as a chance for Kyiv to pay back the U.S. for hundreds of billions in war aid under Joe Biden.
Now we're going to be getting all of that money back, plus a lot more.
Meantime, Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky says the framework of a deal's been reached, but it does not include security guarantees.
If we don't have it, nothing will work.
The president's non-committal.
I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much.
And the full deal could hinge on Friday's meeting. Sagar Magani at the White House.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer heads to Washington on a trip aimed at persuading President Trump to maintain military support for Ukraine. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Starmer's told lawmakers Kyiv must be at the table for any negotiations.
This is about the sovereignty of Ukraine and their ability to decide for themselves the future of their country.
He adds Britain's ready to play a role in providing security guarantees to Ukraine, but reiterates the plan would require US backing.
It's vital that we continue in that role, and that's why my message to President Trump is that the relationship between our two countries needs to go from strength to strength.
Britain's leader echoed earlier prime ministers in emphasizing the special relationship. Starmer's due to meet Trump at the White House on Thursday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
This is VOA News. Israelis have mourned a family that was a symbol of the trauma their country suffered in the Hamas-led October 7th, 2023 terror attack. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Israelis on Wednesday mourned three members of the Bibas family. They lined the funeral procession that carried the bodies of mother Shiri and her sons, four-year-old Ariel and nine-month-old Kfir, on the way to their funeral. The two children were the youngest hostages seized during the attack on Israel. Their bodies were returned to Israel last week as part of a Gaza ceasefire meant to facilitate the return of captives and the release of Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. Thousands of people, some in tears, carrying blue and white Israeli flags or photographs of the family, walked in procession or waited as a convoy bearing the coffins passed their way to the funeral. The Hamas attack killed 1,200 people, according to Israeli tallies. Militants took 251 captives back to Gaza. Israel's air and ground war in Gaza, in response, has killed more than 48,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health authorities, and destroyed most of the coastal enclave. But fighting has stopped since the fragile ceasefire agreement brokered by Egyptian and Qatari mediators last month. Under the deal, Hamas agreed to hand over 33 Israeli hostages in exchange for some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, and the withdrawal of Israeli troops from some of their positions in Gaza, as well as a massive influx of aid. On Wednesday, Egyptian mediators confirmed they had secured a breakthrough that should allow the handover of the final four hostage bodies due in the first phase of the deal this week after a days-long impasse.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. President Trump says he backs billionaire Elon Musk's U.S. government cost-cutting effort. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Musk addressed Trump's first cabinet meeting of the new administration, saying his mission to cut government spending was urgent.
But we're spending like over $1 trillion on interest. If this continues, the country will become de facto bankrupt. It's not an optional thing. It is an essential thing. That's the reason I'm here.
Trump continued to give his full backing to Musk's Department of Government Efficiency cost-cutting team known as DOGE. Federal workers are unhappy with Musk's approach and have sued to protect their jobs, as have other groups who are seeking to block DOGE from accessing government systems and slashing programs. While Musk has waved a chainsaw on stage at a political event in a bold display of his group's efforts, his official role remains unclear, which has complicated the lawsuits against Stooge.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Ukrainians remain optimistic.
88% of Ukrainian citizens surveyed believe victory is possible. But enthusiasm is not as high as it was at the start of the full-scale invasion in 2022.
The UN discusses Sudan.
Respect for Sudan's charter rights, its unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity is vital.
And there's an app that helps you avoid buying a house near neighbors you might not get along with.
Eventually, homebuyers will be able to look up whether their potential new neighbor is a registered Democrat or Republican.
Today is Thursday, February 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Steve Karish. We begin today in Washington. That's where President Donald Trump held the first cabinet meeting of his new administration. However, all eyes were on one person who is technically not in the cabinet, but still has the president's ear. I'm joined by White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wieder-Kuswara for a closer look.
It was extraordinary that Elon Musk, a tech billionaire who does not hold a position in the cabinet, was given the platform in this meeting to discuss his cost-cutting campaign. President Trump invited him to speak about his work at the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which is not technically a department, but an advisory body that is overseeing the slashing of the U.S. bureaucracy under Trump's directive. And Musk expressed confidence that he can cut the $6.7 trillion budget by $1 trillion this year. He said that without these cuts, the country will go de facto bankrupt. And the president praised Musk's recent directive that federal employees email a list of five things that they accomplished last week, something that caused a lot of anxiety among federal employees. And then we saw that not long after the meeting, President Trump signed an executive order directing agencies to work with DOGE to terminate all contracts that he deemed as unnecessary, and instructed the General Services Administration, which manages the government's real estate, to create a plan to get rid of any unneeded property.
Did Musk give any specifics about how DOGE is doing and where or what kinds of savings he's realized?
So he repeated the talking points that the administration have also said, which is that everything has a receipt and they are displayed on what he calls this wall of receipt at the DOGE website. And he did say that there will be mistakes made. He mentioned something to the effect of we cut funding for Ebola. We should not have cut that. And so, you know, this continues to be a source of controversy with a lot of reporting that says those receipts were inaccurate.
Along with DOGE and Elon Musk's personality, Ukraine and the rare earth minerals deal was also a topic of discussion at the cabinet meeting. What's the latest there?
First, he confirmed that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will indeed visit the White House on Friday. This was a source of speculation for a few days. And then he did say that they would sign a rare earth mineral deal that would allow the U.S. to get the money back. That's what he said for the assistance that Ukraine has been given by the Biden administration for Kyiv's efforts to defend itself against Russia's invasion. So the details of that agreement remain unclear. President Zelensky has said that he wants further talks, further agreements that would include U.S. security guarantees to deter further aggression from Moscow. But President Trump indicated quite clearly that the U.S. would not provide any security guarantees and said that that burden should fall to Europe. And we expect this to be a key issue in the meeting between President Trump and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who will be visiting the White House on Thursday.
So along with Ukraine, what else is Prime Minister Starmer expected to discuss with President Trump when they meet?
So Ukraine's definitely a focus, and the other key focus is the bilateral trade ties. I mean, obviously, this is happening as the president is launching more threats on tariffs for the European Union, and also demanding that NATO members rely less on Washington for their security. As we know, President Trump wants NATO members to boost defense spending to 5%, and he doubled down on his stance today at the cabinet meeting, saying that Europe should step up. That American taxpayers shouldn't be footing the bill more than Europeans. And, you know, in In a move that appears to be something done to appease President Trump, on Tuesday, Prime Minister Starmer announced an unexpected increase in the UK's defense budget to 2.5% of the nation's GDP by 2027, and then up again the following year, aiming for up to 3%. So those issues, defense and also European peacekeeping, this is something, a proposal that came when President of France, Emmanuel Macron, visited the White House on Monday. He proposed creating a European peacekeeping force in Ukraine as a security guarantee against future Russian aggression. This was a plan that is endorsed by Starmer and will likely be another key focus in the meeting with President Trump tomorrow.
And we'll leave it there for today. Patsy Wuta-Kuswara is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Patsy, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on all of this information coming from the White House today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
As we've just heard from Patsy, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky comes to Washington on Friday to finalize the rare earth minerals deal between Ukraine and the United States. We've been reporting on that deal here all week. It'll give the U.S. access to Ukrainian reserves of rare earth minerals in exchange for further financial assistance. For a closer look at what that deal includes and what it doesn't, here's VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell.
A deal is in the air, says President Donald Trump, with Ukraine's president coming to the White House to sign a mineral agreement on Friday. The still-developing deal would give the U.S. substantial rights to Kyiv's lucrative rare earth minerals and compensate Washington for weapons sent to Ukraine to fight Russia's three-year war of aggression.
And we're going to be signing an agreement, which will be a very big agreement, and that will be on rare earth and other things.
But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky flagged a key pillar that is not in the current deal: concrete guarantees for Ukraine's security. Earlier Wednesday, Trump effectively dismissed a key Ukrainian wish: membership in NATO.
In this deal, there are only, you know, basic things about that. Yes, security guarantees and etc. But I think it's not about it. Next steps have to be about it. Without future security guarantees, we will not have really just peace, and we will not have really ceasefire, what Trump spoken about. And if we don't have it, nothing will work. So we will have nothing.
Elena Prokopenko of the German Marshall Fund says the minerals deal was part of Zelensky's original peace formulation.
It is difficult for the Ukrainian government to completely go back on the offer. Unfortunately, the deal, the draft deal that was offered to Ukraine in response to this proposal was quite disappointing and quite one-sided. But now that the arrangement seems to be much more balanced, the Ukraine government is ready to sign it.
Prokopenko, a former advisor to Ukraine's finance minister, says she expects some finessing before the deal is signed.
There's some progress in terms of mentioning guarantees as a factor, but it will have to be much more detailed in the final deal, because at the moment there's no specific connection basically in between security and investments. As of now, it looks like an investment deal, but not as a security deal.
And there are other details still to be finalized before this brutal war can end. Russia now controls about a fifth of Ukraine's internationally recognized territory and has vowed to not give any of it back in a would-be peace settlement. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Ukrainian officials said Wednesday that Russian aerial attacks in the Kyiv and Donetsk regions killed at least 7 people. Following news like that, and in the wake of the rift between Trump and Zelensky over negotiations with Russia and early versions of the rare earth minerals deal, uncertainty over waning U.S. support has been increasing among Ukrainians. However, polls find they remain generally optimistic about their country's future. Lysia Bakalets reports from Kyiv.
This part of Independence Square in the center of Kyiv used to be a flower bed until 2022. When the invasion began, people started bringing Ukrainian flags here in memory of fallen soldiers. Over 3 years, the number of flags has increased by the hundreds. 16-year-old Polina is here with a friend.
We brought a flag in memory of our uncle.
There is always someone at the memorial. After 3 years of Russia's invasion, feelings are mixed.
Don't ask me how I feel in the third year of the war. I lost my husband. He was in the military.
I feel despair in my body, anger in my head, and I want my husband back. He went missing from the front 3 months ago.
I don't think about politics. I just want everyone to stay alive so this war can be over, so that we can live under a peaceful sky.
That was Kyiv residents Daria, Ludmila and Lina who declined to give their last names. The non-governmental Kyiv International Institute of Sociology have been working in Ukraine for more than 30 years. Its survey at the end of 2024 suggests most Ukrainians still remain optimistic. Anton Grushetsky is executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology.
More than 80% still believe that Ukraine is capable of achieving success in the war if Western partners properly support it.
A similar study conducted last year by the International Republican Institute finds 88% of Ukrainian citizens surveyed believe victory is possible. But enthusiasm is not as high as it was at the start of the full-scale invasion in 2022. This was to be expected, says Artem Zakharchenko, head of the nonprofit communication analysis team, which has monitored Ukrainians' attitudes on social networks since the first days of the war.
The most difficult thing now is that people don't know what to do to make things better. Right now, a lot of the focus is on Trump and on expectations of what he will do now.
Sociologists also find disappointment, fatigue, and anger are high among Ukrainians' sentiments that are causing some to oppose negotiations. Again, Anton Grushetsky.
There is fatigue, exhaustion, but there is also an understanding that Russia is an existential enemy, and this creates very little room for compromise.
At the same time, polls say people's trust in the armed forces of Ukraine is consistently high at 90%. A U.S.-funded survey by the State Institute of Sociology of Ukraine suggests that patriotism has united Ukrainians during these years. How the country emerges politically is a different question. Sergei Dembitsky is the Institute's deputy director.
Such sacrifices that were made are an indicator of maturity, resilience, and dedication. But when the war is over and we return to our political process, then we will see whether society has grown or not.
Meanwhile, near the memorial, a street musician sings a popular Ukrainian rock band song. It says everything will be fine for each and everyone. Lesia Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
On Wednesday in New York, several members of the UN Security Council expressed concern over the declaration of a parallel government by paramilitaries in Sudan. Barbara Woodward is the United Kingdom's ambassador to the UN.
Deepened divisions risk even further destabilization in Sudan and the region. Respect for Sudan's charter rights, its unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity is vital and will be necessary for a sustainable end to this war.
Just a few days ago in Nairobi, Kenya, Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and its allies signed a founding charter for a separate parallel government in Sudan. Even though the charter was signed in Kenya, the Nairobi government does not recognize it. Esdras Lokale is Kenya's ambassador to the UN.
And I think at this point we wish to clarify that Kenya has not recognized any entity, whether in the Sudan or elsewhere. Recognition of states is a legal phenomenon, the exercise of which is provided for by international law. I reiterate that neither President William Ruto nor the government of Kenya has recognized any independent entity in the Sudan or elsewhere.
Sudan has been ravaged by a vicious civil war since April of 2023. And elsewhere in Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa said that the erosion of multilateralism threatens global growth and stability. Ramaphosa was speaking at the G20 finance meeting in Cape Town, which was marked by the absence of the U.S. Treasury Secretary. The G20, as well as the European Union and the African Union, is divided on key issues from Russia's war in Ukraine to climate change, with world leaders scrambling to respond to drastic policy shifts from Washington since the return of President Trump. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. President Trump said Wednesday that he plans to start selling what he calls gold card visas, with a potential pathway to U.S. citizenship for $5 million. The plan, the president says, will bring wealthy people who create jobs into the U.S. to do business. A child who is not vaccinated has died from measles in West Texas. It's the first death in an outbreak that began there late last month and the first from measles in the U.S. since 2015. The measles outbreak in rural West Texas has grown to 124 cases across nine counties. Texas Health Department data shows most cases in the area have occurred in people younger than age 18. A far right-wing populist who won the first round in Romania's canceled presidential election last year was stopped in traffic by police on Wednesday and taken in for questioning by prosecutors. Kalin Georgescu's communications team said he was about to submit his new candidacy documents for the presidency. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. And in American domestic news, a recent study shows that one in 100 Americans who sold their homes did so because of a neighbor with opposing political views. But a new real estate app allows home buyers to learn about a potential neighbor's politics before they make one of the biggest purchases of their lives. VOA's Dora McQuar reports.
Floor-to-ceiling windows on this side.
Most homebuyers get to know the people who live next door after they move in. But a new real estate app allows homebuyers to learn their potential neighbor's political leanings before making a real estate purchase. Darian Kelly is co-founder of Oizy, a real estate platform.
The purpose of Oizy is to democratize data for buyers in their home search experience.
And Oizy, a new real estate app that's being tested in New York and Florida with the intent to go nationwide, does that by providing information from public records. Eventually, homebuyers will be able to look up whether their potential new neighbor is a registered Democrat or Republican.
It's to get you to the understanding of, when I move here, these are the type of people that I might be inviting over for dinner, the type of people that I will be raising my child alongside.
Ben McCartney is an assistant professor of commerce at the University of Virginia.
People do seem to care about the political identities of their new neighbors, so I'm not surprised that some company is now, you know, selling that information or providing that information to would-be buyers.
Ben McCartney co-authored a study that found homeowners were slightly more likely to move away if a new neighbor's political view differed from theirs than they would if the newcomer were affiliated with their political party.
So political polarization isn't just a social media phenomenon, but is affecting real economic decisions as well.
The study found that one out of every 100 moves is politically motivated. The people most likely to move for this reason tend to be less involved in politics, according to McCartney.
They don't want politics to be part of their everyday life. But then they get a new neighbor, and that new neighbor is not only very politically vocal, but also affiliated with the opposite party. And there's where we see the strongest tensions arise.
But will this sort of app help deepen America's political divide? Oizy co-founder Kelly rejects that notion.
We're giving people the data and the information to control their own destiny and do what they will with that information. The data already exists.
And Oizy's stated goal is to make that public information easier to find. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
The long-awaited Syrian National Dialogue Conference took place earlier this week at the People's Palace in Damascus. Approximately 550 people were there. Syrian Kurdish political parties criticized their exclusion from the event, while the organizing committee stated that invitations were extended to individuals rather than to representatives of political parties or organizations. The Kurdish National Council in Syria called the conference a humiliation and a violation of the principles of the Kurdish people's right to national unity in Syria. Meanwhile, since the Syrian civil war mostly ended in December, fighting has continued outside the city of Manbij, where car bombs have killed dozens. VOA's Heather Murdoch is there.
Fariel Suleiman has lived in a village near Manbij, Syria, all her life. And during the last 14 years of war, it has been a perpetual front line. Hospitals here barely function, and she says it's too dangerous to send her children to school.
The girls were playing ball at the school and it went on the roof. They went to get it and they found a cluster bomb. They started playing with the balls, and when they threw one, it exploded. Two were killed and three were injured.
Suleiman comes here to the city's only working hospital to get treatment for her children. But doctors say they pay out of pocket to run the generators, which they cannot do for much longer. And without electricity, they cannot help patients, officials say, even though this is the only facility serving about 1.5 million people. This is Dr. Amin Noor Al-Mashad, Manbij City Health Chief.
Nobody cares. Manbij is a forgotten city. They don't know where we stand, and it is why there is no support.
Warring parties in Syria, however, care deeply about this strategic city. When the Syrian civil war began in 2011, Manbij was controlled by the government of fallen President Bashar al-Assad. Then it was taken by Islamic State militants. Kurdish forces took it next, building a network of tunnels to connect buildings and store weapons. In late 2024, rebel forces took most of Syria from the regime and Manbij from the Kurds. Yet fighting continues here over control of a key dam outside the city, and car bombs have killed dozens of civilians in recent months, according to the local government. As the conflict goes on, the impoverished and isolated region becomes more and more unstable, says Abdul Al-Monam Al-Mustafa, who heads the city's Civil Society Council.
After 2 weeks, there may be no bread here, but I don't have the capacity to bring bread for 1 million people. We are individuals here, not NGOs or associations.
He says he hopes Syria can unite under one army soon. But Kurdish forces see the Turkish-backed Syrian military holding Manbij as an existential threat. And with U.S. backing, the Kurds also bear a responsibility in their region that no one else wants, tens of thousands of Islamic State prisoners. And while militaries and politicians try to untangle this mess, locals here say to them, the war is not close to ending. Here again is Fariel Suleiman.
Manbij will never have rest. There will be no rest in Manbij.
As is common in Manbij, she doesn't say who she wants to win. Because around here, you never know who will be in charge next. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Manbij, Syria.
And finally today, a little something to think about as you look up at the night sky. A satellite was launched into space from Florida on Wednesday to identify where water might be hidden on the moon's surface in places such as the permanently shadowed craters at its poles. A SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket lifted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, carrying NASA's Lunar Trailblazer orbiter.
2, 1, ignition, and lift off. Go Falcon, go to ignition.
Vehicles pitching downrange.
The lunar surface is often thought of as arid, but previous measurements have found the presence of some water, even in warmer, sunlit locations. In cold and permanently shadowed places at the lunar poles, it's long been hypothesized that there could be significant amounts of water ice. The dishwasher-sized satellite weighs about 200 kilograms and is being sent to find and map this water on the moon's surface. For future moon exploration, including potential long-term lunar bases staffed by astronauts, lunar water would be of vital importance because it could be processed not only as drinking supply, but also into breathable oxygen and hydrogen fuel for rockets. And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Garish.